Luke 14. You might turn to one or two other passages. And this goes very closely with what we looked at in the last hour. The need for spiritual eyesight. The need for spiritual understanding, illumination. Paul prays for that. We should pray for that. And we will look at this passage, this well-known passage, Luke 14, beginning at verse 25, and read down through verse 34. In this passage, we are told that great crowds were coming to Jesus and kept coming. As Jesus sees these crowds coming and keep coming, he is aware of widespread, serious misunderstanding among these great multitudes. It is as if he says, "You are following me to Jerusalem for something like a celebration or an inauguration of this bright new era. You expect my mission to keep to make your dreams come true." He really is saying, in love to you, I must slow your haste to profess attachment to me. One of the great causes of, we could say, spiritual abortion, why people don't come to full term, why their experiences are aborted, is a haste for comfort. A haste for comfort. Be careful about a haste for comfort for yourself and for others. It is not wrong at all to desire comfort. Beware of a haste for it. So, he will lay down the terms here. For you, for any of you, he will say to the crowd, to come to me and really join my company must include abandoning what seems dear and vital to you, plus embracing what is most painful. I told you how strange it would seem for people of ancient times to join us and hear, did I just hear you sing about a cross, a rude instrument of execution? Did you just sing a hymn about that? And the idea, if any of you could have ever seen a crucifixion, you'd say, what has possessed your minds to make a hymn about a cross? But there's nothing wrong with that hymn. What's wrong is with the people's minds who don't understand the true nature of the human condition now and the true nature of the age we live in now. So then I would like to give you a message this morning on responding to widespread misunderstanding of Christianity. Responding to widespread misunderstanding of Christianity. You know, I'm sure, that there is widespread misunderstanding about Christianity. Would you notice, beginning at verse 25, how our Lord Jesus Christ, who loved these multitudes and has a plan for them, seeks to correct misunderstanding about his kingdom and their place and entry into it. And there went great multitudes with him. And he turned and said unto them, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it? Lest haply, after he hath laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or, what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth embassage and desire conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if the salt hath lost his savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land, nor yet for the dunghill. Men cast it out. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Well, you would really need ears to hear that, wouldn't you? You live in an era of widespread, very serious misunderstanding concerning Christianity. You need to understand the necessity of a kind of hatred this passage talks about. Further, you need to understand, you need to grasp the images of a tower. He talks in here about a tower and going to war. I want you to note these things. Did I tell you that it's very serious danger to be in a haste for comfort? Have you ever known anybody who is hasty to buy a car and got a lemon? Maybe some of you have done that. Said, I was in a haste. I wish I wasn't in such a haste. I wouldn't have made this purchase. Well, there's such a thing as being in a haste for spiritual comfort. Maybe you feel really bad. People do. And I just want to point out to you the danger of building a tower or going to war, undertaking a spiritual enterprise without carefully contemplating. For instance, look at verse 28 and verse 31. He says, for which of you intending to build a tower sitteth not down first and counteth the cost? When somebody sits down, like that's what husbands and wives do sometimes, we need to sit down and look over our finances. We need to contemplate it. Okay, those are contemplative images. He says, contemplate. Contemplate with your understanding what's before you. And look again at verse 31 about going to war. Imagine, dear people, imagine going to war hastily without a contemplative plan. Look at verse 31. Or what king going to war against another king? Look at, sitteth not down first and consults. See, when they said we have a war, okay, we need to sit down and consult how we're going to do this. Otherwise, it's certain ruin, isn't it? You don't go to war and just say, well, we haven't contemplated anything. You get a musket, you get a knife, you get this, you get that, off we go, here we go. He said, no, you're going to be blown out. Haste. Be careful. Nothing's more important than your soul, than your spiritual understanding, and those of your neighbors. And it's undoubtedly, you know, there's no contradiction between this passage and the one where Jesus said, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And you'll find rest for your soul. And dear friend, if you will pay attention to this passage, you too will find rest for your soul and help for your neighbors. So let's notice, number one, two points. Number one, hatred of a purely moral kind is required of all of us if we are to be anything more than externally attached to Jesus. Hatred of a purely moral kind is required of us if we are to be anything more than externally attached to Jesus. You're aware, aren't you, that we have multitudes and multitudes and more multitudes in America who are externally attached to Jesus. Almost all the people you work with believe in Jesus. These crowds were attaching themselves to him. But he says, not so fast. You can't be attached to me. You can't be my disciple unless you meet the conditions. And there are many people who are externally attached who have not met the conditions. And here's the condition. Hatred of a purely moral kind is required of all of us if we are to be anything more than externally attached. So notice, if you would please, this is in verse 25, great multitudes follow him. They are a well-disposed multitude. They like him. They are impressed with him. They are hoping that he would do something for them. And these people are, there's a multitude there. And yet, it's apparent in Jesus' words to them that being part of a multitude and being his disciple are two different things. He said, I see you multitudes out there. And you're following me. And you're listening to me. But I want you to know that there's a big difference between being part of a multitude and being my disciple. To be his disciple is actual union with Christ, made alive, strengthened, and taught by his Spirit daily and hourly. For the first, to be acquainted with him, to become the second, you know, to be his disciple requires action on your part. If you're going to be more than externally attached, especially part of a multitude that sort of knows him, and at one of his disciples who action is required on your part. This action is self-chosen separation, a willfully caused breach of things and persons that in some sense are dear. That's, you have to make that breach. Otherwise, you're not his disciple. The action that's required is self-chosen separation on your part. Willful caused breach on your part of things and persons that in some sense are dear, and nothing and no one is accepted of all your relations. This word, look if you would please, verse 26, and notice in the first, second line, if any man come unto me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children. The word hate here is often interpreted love less. And sometimes, and there is legitimacy for that interpretation. For instance, in Matthew 10:37, it says, he that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. So sometimes, when you find that word hate, it simply means love less. Matthew 10:37, for example, that. I do not believe that that's the case here. I do not think that in Luke 14:26, he means love less. It means more than that. It means a kind of hatred. This is the case because Jesus is here regarding our well-beloved ones, father, mother, wife, children, and sisters, don't forget who he's talking to here. Try not to let that get out of your sight. Who is he talking to? Vast multitudes who are following him. These vast multitudes who are following him, there are a wide range of misunderstanding of spiritual knowledge. That's apparent at the beginning of the chapter in Luke 14, which we went over before. Amazing blindness, but we can't go back to that. So keep in mind who he's talking to. And yet we can't water this down. Notice, I'll follow this carefully. This doesn't mean love less. He's talking about hating something, someone, or some things. This is the case because Jesus is here regarding our well-beloved ones, father, mother, wife, children, sisters, as representative, listen now, of our natural condition. That fallen, radically selfish nature that alienates us from God. Therefore, he adds to our natural loves, father, mother, wife, sisters, children. Did you notice there's one I didn't read? Look at the last one. After sisters, yea, and his own life also. The yea in his own life also is clearly referencing his natural condition. His natural condition. In fact, it may be helpful for you to clinch this out by writing Romans. Make a note, perhaps it may help you, by verse 26, his own life also. Romans 6, 21 and 22. And let me, just to help you, put it in context to read it for you. Romans 6. His own life also. Listen to this. The epistles explain what he's meaning, your own life. Okay. Romans 6:21. What fruit had ye then in those things whereof you are now ashamed? He's talking about your former life before conversion. For the end of those things is death. Being now made free from sin, you become servants of God. And some of you could reflect back and said, yeah, I know what that is. And in some sense, everyone should be able to. His own life also, he said, yeah, that I remember my own life also before, in my natural condition. That's nothing to savor. So back to Luke. Yea, in his own life also. You remember what we just read, Psalm 14? And we looked at it in Sunday school. What is the subject matter in Psalm 14 about the whole race? It has little defects or major defects. Doesn't Psalm 14 make the astonishing diagnosis that the whole race you and I are part of is radically selfish? It is. I've told you before, start in a nursery. Give one of them a toy. There's a whole nursery full of toys, and the one will grab the other and say, let me have that toy. Give me that thing. Radically selfish. Those of you who are in business or do tax work, you look and say, how unbelievable the creative theft that the people have. Even though a lot of these people don't need to steal. They got plenty of stuff. Okay, now, our subject this morning is responding to widespread misunderstanding of Christianity. And here's my first point. Hatred of a purely moral kind. Purely moral kind. Is required of us if we're to be anything more than externally attached to Jesus, if we're to be his disciples. There's a hatred that's required. Things are to be hated only so far as they partake of this principle of sin, alienation, and corruption. For instance, this will become clearer now. Turn, please. Keep your place, will you? In Luke 14. And would you turn, please, to Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy 21. It would be helpful for you to look at this. And this puzzling passage, frightening passage, intentionally alarming passage, will begin to come into focus for you in a way I think you keep it and clinch it And folks, people's conditions, so the stakes are high, and this sort of passage is needful. Jesus spoke it. It's an infallible address to multitudes who have deeply ingrained, widespread misunderstanding about true religion. All right, let's look at Deuteronomy 21, verse 18 through 21. Now, we just read a passage. Jesus said, to the multitudes, to the vast multitudes of fallen people whose understanding is seriously marred, and he makes some alarming statements to them quite intentionally about their best beloveds, usually. Father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister, and yet his own life. All right, now here we have, look at this one, Deuteronomy 21, 18, and listen to this. If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them. Okay, here is a totally, completely thoroughgoing rebel, and he's a son. Then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out to the elders of the city and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. And this son gets the death sentence. And that's what it says. Now, the reason this penalty is issued, listen carefully. The reason this penalty is issued is purely moral. He is not hated because he is a son. That's not why they hate him. He is not hated or judged because he's a Jew or because he's short, tall, thin, or fat. None of those things. There's only one reason why this terrible judgment is issued to him. It's a moral one. He's a glutton, he's a drunkard, he's incorrigible, he's unchangeable. And so, let's turn back to Luke 14, where we began this alarming statement. That's the only issue in Deuteronomy is the purely moral one. There aren't any other issues there. It's not because he's a son, not because he's a Jew, tall, short, thin, fat, rich, poor. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is his moral condition. Okay. For you to become a disciple of Jesus, you're going to have a hatred of a purely moral kind. The only issue in Luke, when he says to hate things or persons is a moral one. That's the only issue. It's a moral one. In other words, spiritual morality is as God sees it. There are things and persons to be hated only so far as they partake of this principle of sin, alienation, corruption. You know, don't you, that God hates things. These six things does the Lord hate. A proud look, a lying tongue, and a number of other things, and he that sows discord among the brethren. God hates those things. Are you to hate those things? Yes. God hates them, and I must hate them. Now, look back at Luke, and a question before moving on. Still, I think though your ears have to tingle and say, I'm still not sure if I understand that. Hate father, mother, wife, children, brethren, sisters. Yeah, he's on the Okay, how about, I want to ask you this question before we move on. Recently, the Wilson children surprise celebration of their parents' 30th wedding anniversary. Was that in contradiction to Luke 14:26? Look at your Bible, would you? And you remember we just had the celebration? Now, I want to try to fit this into your understanding. Look at it. If any man comes to me and hate not his father, mother, and wife, and children, and brethren, and sisters, in his own life also, he can't be my disciple. So here's a question for you. That lovely, pleasant, and splendidly well done surprise celebration, was that a contradiction of this passage? And the answer, with two words in it, when it begins with N, is what? No. There isn't any contradiction in that whatsoever. There's nothing in this passage that discourages you as a single-minded believer to throw your arms around your well-beloved ones, father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister. There's nothing in there that hinders you, discourages you in the least from throwing your arms around them and telling them that you love and appreciate them. Back to the multitudes. The only issue there, the only hatred is a purely moral hatred is required. Okay, we'll say more about that in just a moment. There, not only is there nothing in this passage that discourages you in the least from loving your loved ones with an appropriate love in the Lord and including natural affection, but there's nothing in this passage that restricts you from richly enjoying countless good and perfect gifts that come down from the Father of lights, both material gifts and immaterial. Nothing in there. There isn't any contradiction here with you take my yoke and learn of me and you'll find rest for your soul. So let's come back to the multitudes. However, the multitudes, look at verse 14, or chapter 14, verse 26, chapter 14, verse 25. And there were very great multitudes of Jews. Misunderstand Jews. Radically selfish Jews. Not just because they're Jews, but that's what they're about. They're unconverted people, by and large. Their understanding doesn't work. What they want fixed isn't what needs to be fixed most of all. They are, as multitudes are today, hasty for comfort. Well, they really don't have it fixed in the first place, why they're uncomfortable in the first place. It's their radically defective, immaterial nature, which is evil. And that is to be the thing hated. So let's come back to them. He comes back to the multitudes that are hasty for comfort, seriously misunderstanding their own nature, their own needs, and they misunderstand the character of the age they live in, which is energized by the powers of darkness, shaping the values. So these people are in a heap of trouble. They don't discern the character of the age they live. They don't understand their own character. That's called being blind. That's what we looked at earlier this morning. Why they need spiritual understanding for the lights to go on. All right, look now at the second and last point. Two images help them and us embrace the conditions of discipleship. Look at verse 28. After alarming them, and folks, you're used to hearing about crosses, but you've never seen anything like a crucifixion. And maybe some of you watched the movie that somebody made, The Crucifixion of Christ. But still, these people had seen them real. And those people were astonished at what they heard. They were supposed to be. The shock is intentional. And so he is now, look at verse 28, 4. He's going to explain. So why did I just lay down these shocking images and facts to you? And he says, for which of you intending to build a tower? That was an image there, the tower. There's no possibility these people following Jesus apart from meeting the state and conditions. They don't imagine anything like this. Therefore, Jesus tells them and us two indispensable images. The tower is the first one. A tower is a lofty edifice that strikes the eye from afar, said one person. That's what a tower is. I grew up in Cleveland. And we have in Cleveland a terminal tower. And I have in our house a set of Compton's encyclopedias that was printed in 1954. I think my dad used to sell Compton's encyclopedias. And we got a set. And I just looked it up. I thought, I'm going to look up tower, the terminal tower. And would you believe, in that encyclopedia, it said the terminal tower in Cleveland, which we live not that far from, was the second tallest building in the United States when that encyclopedia was printed, 1954. 708 feet. And I remember looking forward to going downtown. We get to see the terminal tower. You can see it from far off. Look at that verse 28, building a tower. Jesus, do you understand there's a sense in which you're a tower? A tower is a lofty edifice that strikes the eye from afar. We live in a radically depraved culture. Your character is to strike the eye of people and said, look at that. Look at that lady. There's something different about her. There's something strikingly different. You know, like a tower is different from all the buildings around it and say, wow, look at that thing. Look at verse 28. Which of you intending to build a tower doesn't sit down and contemplate the cost? There is a sense in which, translated spiritually into a mode of living, distinguished from common surroundings. You know, a tower is different from other surrounding buildings. You're different. I hope. What if you're not different? What if you're just like the rest of the culture? Well, nothing could be worse than that. Nothing. Now, Christians are by the design and placement of God, they're towers, and translated spiritually. They're distinguished from common surroundings. That's your calling. That was Israel's calling. They missed it. Don't you miss it. We are a distinguished people. Exodus 33:16 says, for wherein shall it be known that I and thy people have found grace in thy sight? Is it not that thou goest with us? So shall we be separate, distinguished from all the people on the face of the earth. So, what happens to somebody who's hasty to get the building up and doesn't contemplate the cost? Maybe you've seen one. There is a house over on Pitchkettle, and that thing was under construction when we moved here 25 years ago. And nobody's lived in it. It's a great big, it's a 6,000 square foot brick house. Well, look at the passage. Lest haply, verse 29, after he hath laid the foundation, he be not able to finish it. All that behold, it began to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. In other words, his religion becomes something of a ridicule. Look at that. See, when people are hasty for comfort, they hastily embrace religious schemes and they don't work. And you know, people hastily embraced Christianity, and sometimes we're guilty of hastily luring them into it. Say, look, oh, I read to you one the other day. My neighbor is planning a church downtown Suffolk. Say these words. Thou shalt confess with thy mouth and believe in thy heart that God has raised him from the dead. Thou shalt be saved. For with the heart man believeth unto righteousness, and with the mouth profession is made unto salvation. Thank you, Lord, I'm saved. That's what the tract says. That's haste. That's insane, fatal haste. That's common. There are lots of people that they haven't taken into account the need, what they really are naturally, and what needs to be done about it. And you can see haste is the point there. One should therefore make an estimate before building, and not only make an estimate, but accept the cost and toll it will require. In other words, Jesus is telling them, do you understand that the plan I have for you is going to cost you something? Do you understand that this will be a toll on being my disciple? Well, let me put it to you this way. Early in the New Testament, in Matthew, for instance, Matthew 7:13, we are told of two roads in life, just two. That's all there are as far as this goes. One is called straight and narrow. The other is broad. One leads to life. The other leads to destruction. What can you tell me this morning about a traffic report on those roads? You know, you hear traffic reports. Those of you listen to them and say 64 is crowded. Matthew, early in the New Testament, just describes two roads in life. One is broad and one is narrow. And what could you tell me about the traffic report on them? Which one is crowded? It's the broad one. And it's leading to destruction. And the narrow one? What about that one? The one that leads to life. Well, that one doesn't have near as many people on it. But it's the one you need to be on. And a person hasty for comfort will just buy a religious formula and say, well, we're in. Oh, what a disaster that is. One more image. And look at this one. This one has to do with going to war. Conflict. You know, we live in a world of conflict. Look at verse 31. Or what king going to make war against another king doesn't contemplatively estimate this conflict? Well, you take somebody who's hasty and just doesn't contemplate their enemy, especially look at the size of the enemy. Remember, we sang Luther's hymn. Luther's a little German man, and he is way outnumbered. Man, is he ever outnumbered. But Luther sees what other people don't see. He says, look at this one. Here is, he describes, and you're supposed to do the imaging. You're supposed to do some of the consideration. These people can't. They're blind. And he says, stop. Don't profess attachment to me till you understand something about building a tower. You're going to be distinguished from others. Are you prepared for that? The toll, the cost of that. And let me tell you about the conflict. Are you prepared to be in the minority? Here's a king going against another. He's got 10,000 against somebody who's 20. That means it's 2-1 against you. That's not a precise statistic. It's a generalization to make the point that you're outnumbered. Now, are you prepared for such a thing as that? Will that surprise you that you came out, that you chose to follow him and found out I'm way outnumbered? Luther was way outnumbered. He followed anyway. You're way outnumbered. How are you going to follow? A combatant going to war. In other words, there's a contemplation here. Who is the other king in this? The other king is Satan. You know, we read about him last in the previous hour. He said, Paul, your mission is to turn their eyes from the power of Satan to the power of God. That's a frightening reality that people like to dismiss. And modern thinkers say, that's a scandal. You can't think that. Well, modern thinkers can think what they will think, but he's still there. And you're going to be in conflict with him. Are you prepared for that? Have you consulted about that? Well, what this comes down to, the consulting and the warfare, and I'll conclude shortly. That includes concluding what you and other people are naturally. I would sit down and contemplate that well. What is the society I'm a part of? Is it a biological accident where there are no real morals? That's what the modern thinkers come up with. We're biological accidents, and we just existentially make up morals. What do you say we are? What are you naturally? Then this, what is out there to oppose you? What are the results of this conflict likely to be short term? When Luther said, you know what the conflicts are going to, the likelihood of this is going to be for me? If I go down there, if I face Rome with the truth of the gospel, my head will roll. And he said, but I'm doing it anyway. And if God spares me, he spares me, but I'm going. See, he counted the cost, didn't he? Luther, he wasn't wondering, these are perfectly rationally fellows and we'll just hash it out and it'll all just a little misunderstanding and we'll smooth it over and it'll be fine. Oh, no. No, Luther counted the cost. He said, I'm going. And his friends told him, you know, you could, this could be it. Are you prepared for anything like that? This could be it. Two examples that could help us clinch this. And here's one. You don't have to turn to any of these. Do you remember Stephen? You know, if you follow the Lord, and when they're getting ready to go to Jerusalem, and these people are going to be shocked that the Messiah himself is going to be crucified. So let's just think about this from appearances. Appearances can be very misleading, but I'll just give you two. One, Stephen, when he was stoned to death by satanically energized authorities in Jerusalem, who lost short term? Well, Stephen did. Man, if you're a guy in your midlife and you get stoned to death in public, I'd call that a loss, wouldn't you? How about long term? And what about those who stoned him? I bet they were delighted. I bet they went home. I bet they went home talking about it. He said they should have seen it. Did you see when his ribs broke? Did you see when his head crushed? Stinking Nazarene follower. I bet they talked just like that. We got him. We won. Did they? Here's another one. We live in a very erotic age, and there's one in Matthew 14 and 10 to 12, and there's a story about a man named John the Baptist, a mighty man. And he understood what human beings are. He said, you people are fallen. And you're responsible to God, and including in your marriage and behavior and all, and the authorities didn't like it. And a young woman danced and got the king's vow to do anything she would ask of him. And you're aware John the Baptist lost his head. So short term, who's the loser? I would call that a loss. I'd say that's another one. And I bet the wicked mother probably cackled with glee. Last time one of these preachers will get on me about my marriage. And I bet she did, but I don't think she's doing that now. Yeah, John the Baptist lost. Are you prepared to lose short-term anything? You know that could happen to you, don't you? Happened to Stephen. Happened to John the Baptist. Happened to many others. Are you prepared for that to happen? Say, no. That interferes with my plans for comfort. No. Count me out. Well, he talked here about, and you, listen, as you can, some of you have been Christians a long time, and none of this has really been a surprise to you, maybe a refresher. But I would just conclude this way. Who are the people who are often the main and key ones that prevent people from following the Lord by their interference? You know who it is? It's their family. A lot of them, part of the family said, I want to follow the Lord. And other brothers and sisters say, don't. There's an easier way to have the comfort you want and deserve. It's often the parents. I'm talking about unsaved people. It's often the parents say, don't follow him. Don't embrace Christianity. Be a little religious if you want to, but don't follow him. That often, who is it but the parents? And all of you could think of people. And it's their parents that stand in the obstacles of their children coming to the Lord. And many of you are aware, if brothers and sisters, and it's happy are you if you are, you have brothers or sisters who encourage you in the Lord to follow the Lord. Let me assure you, all people don't. Lots of people, it is their brothers. It is their sisters who are the stumbling block. And folks, that doesn't just apply to coming to the Lord in the first place. That applies to following the Lord. In a pleasure-oriented society that said, look, we're making it way too hard. Well, there's such a thing as that. I think I've told you enough, but Jesus himself counted the cost. He was in the wilderness, tempted 40 days of the Satan, and he knows the power of darkness, and he knows the terms. And I want to encourage you to renew your complete dedication to the Lord and say, Lord, everything I have and everything I am belongs to you. And you're free to make any changes you want to make. And folks, don't worry. If your family is following the Lord, there isn't anything in that passage that discourages you in the least from throwing your arms around them, tell them you love them, appreciate them, and manifest your kindness and love and goodwill in manifold ways. Shall we bow for prayer? So, Lord God, we come unto you this morning.